Coming up on Life is a Festival.
When that relationship ended, I literally lost my home. Like, I moved out, she stayed, it made a lot more sense for her to do so. From that place, that reactivity, I was like, that's it, I'm not going to play into that anymore. I'm going to go the exact opposite, which in this case, and for many often, is the open relating, the non-monogamy, the polyamory. And it can feel like liberation, certainly after a time that felt more repressed and more boxed in. And yet what I found, like many do, and this is the polyagony, which is that all of the same issues that came up in the monogamous relationship just come up times however many, you know, people you're relating with. And so what I realized from that experience, and then finally going to Tamara, was I was like, oh, the missing piece has really little to do with the form of relationship that people are choosing to have, monogamy, polyamory, celibate, whatever. It's not about the form, it's about the vessel.
Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. I am your host, Eamon Armstrong. Now, if you've listened to this show for some time, you may be familiar with Ian McKenzie, who has often been a guest on this show, as I have been on his. He hosts a program called the Mythic Masculine Podcast, and we often talk about matters of gender and sexuality and love and masculinity. And it seems I've been doing a lot on sex and love lately, and today's episode is no different. In fact, this is a re-edit and re-release of a podcast that I did with Ian and his collaborator, Julia Marianska, on their film about the free love, open relating, healing biotope called Tamara in Portugal. This was released in 2019, and it is about both Tamara and the film, which is called Village of Lovers, that they collaborated with a fellow named John Wolfstone on. And that film is now available in a global streaming premiere on February 7th. So I wanted to re-release this episode in honor of that film. And it also pairs with a global gathering, a summit called A Cry from the Future, which has some guests from this program, some visionary leaders, and there's information about that in the show notes. So, today on the show, we're talking about free love, open relationships, and especially this really inspiring space called Tamara in Portugal, which is an intentional community for love. I like saying love like that. Doesn't it sound lovely? Love. It makes it sound like it doesn't have all the problems that it has. But here's the thing. Free love seems to have a lot of problems, and Tamara has prototyped ways of addressing them. And that's a big part of why Ian and his collaborators went there to learn about it. So on the show, we talk about the origin and evolution of Tamara. Julia talks about her experience with One Taste, which was another sexuality-based intentional community, and contrasts that with Tamara. We talk about how when you are working on personal healing in witness of community, it is in the service of the collective, and why that matters, particularly in romantic relationships. We talk about free love and the myth of the one. I'm trying to think of who says love. Oh, you know who says love like that? Is if you've ever done a Vipassana, Goenka says love like that. So if you've done the 10 days of silent meditation, he goes love. And it just, he sounds so lovely. So a bit of a ladies man, Goenka. No, I'm kidding. So we talk about free love and the myth of the one. We talk about what we should do if we can't all just go and live at the love school of Tamara. We discuss the erotic and eco-villages. There's a beautiful thing about dealing with jealousy and how to be a brother in the context of romantic connections. We talk about making contact by dropping your story and a more advanced way of thinking about what we colloquially refer to as consent. We discuss women's safety in polyamorous spaces. And finally, we land with why the personal is in fact political, and healing gender relationships is a political act. So, folks, strap on in. This is an episode that if you haven't heard it, I think you'll enjoy it. And if you have heard it, I did a whole re-edit. I made it tighter and cleaner and better. And it's actually really fun to go back over an episode that you did, you know, a couple of years ago and see how your sort of editing and streamlining has changed since then. And I can say that I'm quite proud of the way that this information is presented for you. So my friends, my fellow travelers, let us love deeper and better and let us let go more easily. And I think the answer is community and creating communities of care, cultures of care. And Tamara is the global leading model on this particular thorny challenge. So without further ado, here are my friends, Ian McKenzie and Julia Marianska. I am here with Julia Marianska and also Ian McKenzie. Hi, Ian.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Ian.
This is Julia. You are my first time meeting. And Ian and I know each other pretty well. And I am thrilled because I am so interested in Tamara. And you have both put together a film. And it's specifically about the Tamara Love School or Tamara, the entire Tamara community.
That's an interesting distinction because we were invited to participate in the Love School, which is a 10-day immersion within the community, and particularly in their research in love and sexuality. But we realized in the course of making the film, which initially started as a sort of play-by-play of being in the Love School, we then realized it was more broadly effective to actually treat the journey of the watching the film, experiencing the film, as a whole love school unto itself. So that the experience at Tamara is the love school that the audience is then drawn into.
So could this podcast be an experience of a love school? Can we do that? Julia?
I think we can do our best to, to bring in the spirit of the love school.
Yeah.
What would make this podcast a home run for you both?
Great question. I think that if we successfully have you at the end of the podcast fully getting what it is that the love school is about, and not just on the surface level of, sure, we all on some level want love and we all want sex, but to understand the more holistic concept of it, how it has to do with the political revolution of our times, that would be the home run.
I might add as well that part of the practicing of the love school, what we learn in the love school, is to align with Eros. And we'll probably speak about that in the podcast, but that both Julie and I, as collaborators, as former lovers, as now in this moment speaking with you, if we can also bring in and embody and liberate what wants to come through in the spirit of life and service to life, then I also think that could be a home run.
So what you're saying is that we can effectively model some of the experience of the love school in the process of this conversation and therefore allow me to understand deeply what the love school intends to achieve beyond simply the conceptual idea of a healing of the relationship between genders as a political movement and actually perhaps even feel it in my own body and experience. And then that's the win.
Let's do it.
Lucky me. Okay. All right. Fasten your safety belts. Okay. So we're going to need to start by defining some terms. There are lots of hippie communes. There are lots of cool places where people are trying to do cool things. Tamara is in Portugal. It was founded in 1978, and still going strong. So, you know, we hear about a lot of these communes, they dissolve into murder and mayhem and mass suicides. I mean, that's obviously not the norm, but Tamara has kept its vibe, which I'd like to know about how that happened at some point in the conversation. But can you start by locating us in Portugal with the Germans, Josefa Germans? With the Germans who came to Portugal to make this fabulous love school.
Thank you. Yeah, so Tamara actually started largely from the meeting of three people, Dieter Doom, Sabine Lichtenfels, and Charlie Rainier. And when they got together in an initial project in Germany, they initially found that, hey, we want to do this thing together, create this utopian alternative. And then they realized immediately, of course, how challenging it was to actually live together with other human beings without all the stuff, all the same stuff coming up. And so in some sense, I feel that's when the pivot happened with, hey, let's do this thing. Let's build this community or university. And they realized, oh, wait, but first we have to figure out how to live together. And that was the shift.
And the experiment started with just 10 people living in a house. And so they discovered very quickly that within that, if they didn't address the issues of love and sexuality, they would be perpetuating the same thing that they experienced the previous generation do, which is essentially hit a dead end, right? Because there was that hippie movement with the free love and all that. But so many people crashed and burned from that experience and got flung to 180 degree other end and ended up not believing that that could be true without getting hurt.
Yeah, the road to utopia is strewn with burnt out hippies. Right? And yeah. And that's the lesson that we get in the with the yuppies is yeah. that the hippie movement was idealistic, and then everybody kind of woke up and realized that the world was really sinister and nefarious, and that we just needed to like accumulate as many things as mm-hmm. possible, and then we, you know.
Yeah, and I do want to not skirt too that largely, or say the other factor that was happening was the controversies that was happening, I think, around other communities around the time that were failing in Germany as well. And Tamara got roped into a lot of the controversies where, you know, you do such edgy stuff with close proximity to a culture that itself is like, you know, you touch these places, it can be very hostile to you.
Touch these places, what places?
These places of like liberating sexuality and the ways in which they would unearth and actually point to these really deep places of like trauma and wounding in the culture. And so largely they became the subject of a lot of slander. And eventually, that was one of the reasons as well. That was like, look, we have to be able to go elsewhere to a place where there's a bit more space where we can really conduct the research in a bit more of a protected environment.
I think a good inroad to Tamara and to the value of the work being done there as we get into these concepts would be to actually talk about your individual journeys to mm-hmm. Tamara. Mm-hmm. Ian, you and I have known each other for a while, and I'm familiar with your journey to Tamara because you're the reason I know about Tamara. Mm-hmm. Julia, I'm not as sure about how you got there. I know that you were at one point involved in the One Taste community, mm-hmm. which is an interesting parallel to Tamara. So I don't know if that where that fits in with the story for you. And yeah. you've been involved in activism in various ways in your life. So can you set the tone for yeah. how Tamara came into your life?
So I'm a California transplant, if you will. Is that what we call ourselves? I didn't grow up here. But when I moved to the West Coast in 2010 or 11, I moved directly into a community in San Francisco called One Taste. So for those that are not familiar with it, it's an intentional community focused around a partnered practice of orgasmic meditation. And that community was the first intentional community experience that I'd ever had. And it was intense. Yes, very focused on the unearthing of layers of repression that we might have on sexuality and how to come into more feeling and more being more sensate as human beings of all genders, essentially.
Orgasmic meditation, also called oming. Yeah. Would you mind describing what that is?
Yeah, it's a partnered practice in which any person of any gender strokes a female clitoris for 15 minutes. And it's a very simple practice. You wouldn't stroke any harder than you would stroke your own eyelid. And it has a very clear start and stop point. And the point is only to feel. And part of what One Taste talks about is that orgasm is not climax. It's the moment that you enter into the involuntary state.
Oh, okay.
I got your attention.
Yeah, the process of learning about love is already happening. That's a beautiful description because so much about sex and the focus on the orgasmic finish line and achievement and success is a lot about, did you come? Did I make you come? Am I good enough to make
right,
you come?
Totally. It's all about that end goal. And so here was a community that I found myself in that was exploring this terrain. And of course, from there, living in San Francisco, I learned about Burning Man and I went to Burning Man for the first time. And I was at Camp Mystic, where I had camped for several years since that first time I'd gone. And I was listening to someone on stage and I remember Daniel Pinchbeck responding to a person on stage saying, well, if you're interested in community, blah, 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 have you heard about Tamara? And it just piqued my interest. And that was 2012. And so I'd been holding that in my awareness, like, okay, there's this place. And I knew that they did work around love and sexuality. And I knew that they did a lot more than that as well.
I'd like to offer, however you feel comfortable, as we talk about Tamara, to maybe bring in a little bit about the contrast with the One Taste community in terms of sustainability in communities built around sexual exploration and open relating, because I think that there are some really interesting parallels there.
Yeah, that's a great point. And there are a lot of distinctions to make between those communities. I think the first distinction I want to say is that at the time I lived there, it was still very much in the first stages before it had gone sort of global and turned into a giant enterprise. And so it really was a sense of, there was a sense of community in that iteration that I was a part of. There were about 50 people living in 30 rooms in a converted hotel in Soma in San Francisco. The community was centered around orgasmic meditation, and it was just that. So it wasn't about let's plant a garden and let's do all these other things, but it did have a map for relating based on that practice that included ways to communicate, ways to deal with fear, ways to approach desire, ways to understand, a lot of things related to sexuality. And it was very focused on the individual, right? So often what happened was people were just very encouraged to go very deep into themselves. Whereas I feel like when I approached Tamara and their work, it was so much about, sure, be in your story in service of the collective healing. And so that's where I was so transformed in that first experience of the Love School in Oakland with the forum practice, because I witnessed person after person coming into the center and speaking to their own trials, tribulations, desires, fears about love and sexuality. But it was always linked to a greater, more universal frame, and it was held in a context of collective healing. And that wasn't something that I felt fully at One Taste.
Ian, you wrote recently in an article about this experience of the forum. And what you wrote was, a strange and wonderful process of inviting individuals into a shared space to be facilitated in a, quote, performance of their inner world. This raw and powerful ritual enables the ability to disidentify with their personal issue and see it as a collective issue within a wider cultural context. It's so easy to get wrapped up in my healing, my trauma, my hero's journey. And the pivot point of the hero's journey, particularly through the mythopoetic men's movement, which we've talked about, is the idea of actually the slaying of the dragon is the slaying of yourself, and the key to the hero's journey is the boon back to the community. This idea that you can disidentify with the personal issue by it being a collective issue, and that your working of your personal issue is in service to the collective, that strikes me as liberating, and also perhaps in some ways kind of an antidote, in a sense, to our myopic, self-consumed, personal journey, voyage thing that we so often find ourselves on, as I've done.
I came to Tamara, well, they first invited me because they saw a film I'd done called The Revolution is Love with a fellow Charles Eisenstein.
Is he a member of that community? Because I saw him. He's in the new film.
He attended a love school with his partner, Stella.
Great.
And so, he's featured somewhat in the film. But they initially invited myself, having already connected with John, who, as you mentioned, who's the other filmmaker in our trio. And they said, hey, would you like to come and see what we were doing with love and sexuality here? I think you'd be intrigued by it. And for me, I was just, one email of many, and I didn't really notice it at the time beyond, oh, that's interesting. And it was a couple years later when my marriage ended for different reasons, and largely a lot of themes that then became very clear to me once I went to Tamara. But basically that was the moment I thought, okay, in the aftermath of deep heartbreak, I need to understand love more. And so that was the time I went, 2015, after John and I raised some funds to do a short film about the community. And we headed there, we attended the Global Love School. And it was day two, actually, when I experienced the forum for the first time. One way to understand it, I think, is that so many of us have these two worlds, right? We have the inner world and we have the outer world. And in largely in the culture, as most of us experience, we're not really allowed to show the inner world. Most people aren't quite, don't know how to handle it or deal with it, or perhaps have to pretend often because it's a way to feel like, okay, I'll get love or I'll be accepted. And if people really knew who I was or my thoughts, I'd be out of the tribe. There's these really base existential fears that many carry. And so with Tamara, they decided, look, what if it's, let's just stop pretending, but let's create the spaces where that inner world can actually be experienced and expressed. And largely too about lines that we have with others that can often run the show unless they're actually given a space in order to be expressed, witnessed, seen, facilitated.
Lines with others. Can you describe a little more clearly what you mean by that? That need to be expressed in a certain way?
Yeah. It's this question for me of any relationship, right? That there's often what, you know, you tell the person and then everything else you think about them or will never tell them or want to tell them but don't, or attractions to them. There's just so much going on. And especially in a community, of course, there's so much going on between so many people. And often without the proper spaces for these things to be expressed, made visible, this is what ends up taking down communities. So we're back again to that idea of why did so many utopian experiments fail? They understood it's because this inner world was never properly excavated and held in a collective process where it could be seen, moved through, and actually create more trust in a community instead of take it down. And so Forum for me was the first time I saw this happening. And I was like, what is this? And I was actually the third person that, quote, performed that day. And they called it a performance more as a kind of invitation not to fake it as we think performance might be, but just to, again, be playful, to not grip it so tightly of what your issue is, but to be able to play it. For example, what is anger to you in this moment? Play it out. Or what is to be the archetype of the hero? Play it out in the middle with facilitation that can guide you so you don't get stuck in your own story too much, right? Or stuck in the head.
There's a way that the Forum really only makes sense in community. Mm-hmm. Mm. And outside of a community context, what could happen is that without a larger frame holding the people together, we could still very much easily go into our downward spirals of our individual stories. For example, if you were to step into the center with a story of like, oh, woe is me, I have this part and I need healing, like however you are relating to that, it might still live that way even as you play it out. However, if you are in a context of community that's committed to seeing and unearthing what the society has suppressed and to come together in a context of healing across the gender spectrum, then let's say you automatically, just because of the field that's being held, get lifted up and out of an individual story, knowing that you reveal something in yourself in service to a greater collective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. I love the story of Hanuman, the Monkey King. He forgot his power because he was reckless and remembered his power in service of Ram. And then he was able to jump to Lanka to find Sita for Ram. But part of the story of Hanuman's devotion is this idea that the great strength is found in service. Mm-hmm. And perhaps part of that story in terms of this performance of self in the service of the collective is that maybe the firepower you need to really go the distance and alchemize these disparate parts of yourself, maybe that could only happen in the crucible of a community for which you are avatar.
Mm-hmm. That sounds epic.
Does that sound epic? Am I hyping it too much? Is everyone going to go to Tamara? Or is it maybe it's subtler?
I just want to say one piece, which is that there's this added element of the fact that when you are in community with others, they are then automatically invested in reflecting back to you what you might not be able to see yourself. And in that way, we're not just getting together for a weekend workshop to do some personal excavation. We go home all healed. But let's say if we're actually living in community, real issues are coming up all the time, daily, many times a day. And then it's a practice of building trust with others to reveal yourself and allow them to give you a reflection. And so in that way, it creates this indebtedness and embedment with one another.
So a question about community then. The love school is something that you can attend as an outsider. So then how are you in community? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the love school was generated for a very specific reason, which one was because they realized that they had all of this research now. And the way they share is that they traveled around all these conferences and they would be speaking about what they're doing in Tamara, because they do, for example, really profound work with water retention landscapes and permaculture.
With what?
Water retention landscapes.
Water retention landscapes. Okay.
Yeah. Permaculture. They build blueprints for like refugee settlements. The love and sexuality piece is one of a larger mandala of what they do.
And they call it a peace village or a peace research.
Healing biotope.
Healing biotope.
Yeah, okay. Which is part of a larger vision. But just to say that they're at these conferences and saying, here's what we're doing with water retention and new technologies. And then people would be like, yeah, it's great. And then in between, like in the hallways, you know, other people would stop them, like great visionary leaders and activists. And they'd say, oh yeah, but tell us about the love thing. What's going on with the love thing? And so it was such a like obvious thing for them to say, oh wait, I guess this is important, because everybody keeps telling us that, you know, there's no place for it out in the activist world and the world where, again, like the same level of suppression, the same level of the hidden inner world, you know, especially a lot of activists suffer from burnout of this kind of, we got to give it all to the cause, but their own lives are in shambles. You know, they understood that actually those two need to come together, but they need to come together in a community, again, that is all committed to deep system change, of which that is like it's their North Star.
I'm still unclear on how, if you are attending Tamara for a 10-day mm-hmm. immersion, mm-hmm. that then puts you in a village environment that is Tamara. Mm-hmm. I understand that they have developed technologies by living in community with each other. And I definitely want to really talk about what free love means in the context of Tamara, what they're whispering in the corridors about the love thing, because I don't think we've properly expressed that here yet. But I still don't get how you're in community if you're just attending the love school.
Yeah. So the invitation, at least as well, when we were first offered it, was it's much closer to a vision quest or some kind of immersion within this field. Also, again, knowing that it's 10 days, and that it is about coming into an existing field that is supported actually by the community. So there's quite a number of community members that are participants and in a level of support with these global allies and activists and artists and leaders that are now able to come to a place and actually experience through that field and the way that it's held a level of personal revelation and integration and healing for that time. And they understand that it is an ongoing process. For example, I've been 4 times now, Julie has been 3. And so it's similar to everything that happens then really has its way with you for the rest of the year. And then you return again to deepen one more time.
And I think I recall that you have to do an introduction session before, because I wanted to go to the love school and you're like, well, you can't just go to love. You have to first do an introduction where you're connecting and understanding the community first, right? Yeah. So there's some level of initiation before going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the love thing, obviously you're listening at home and you're like, the love thing, that is, I've heard about Tamara, or many of you probably have not, but if I've heard about Tamara, I've heard about free love and this idea that free love is going to just save the world.
It's falling from the sky. It's falling free for everybody.
It's free love. And free love, does that mean polyamory? Is that the right word? Or open relating or non-monogamy? What is free love?
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the definition that my friend and collaborator Ida Shibley speaks to. She's a Palestinian Bedouin woman and also featured in the film. And she speaks to this concept of free love. It's sort of an abbreviated concept, because what they really mean is love free of fear, violence, and lies, right? So love is free anyway, right? We don't pay for love. It's a state of being. It's something that we exchange as beings. And so this idea that a free love community can exist, it's a community that's committed to love free of fear, violence, and lies. And so that's a baseline foundation for them. So within that, that manifests as telling the truth and manifests as mutual support and manifests as transparency. So it creates a code of ethics by which people are living by and creating a whole culture around. So that's where free love is actually, it doesn't mean that you have to go and sleep with everybody or multiple people. It's that what you do is you are committed to living your truth in love and living what is healing for love. So each person is going to have his, her, or their own track of healing and moving toward what is best in service to that. And that might look like having multiple partners, because Maybe your upbringing was such that you were really repressed and were not able to explore your longings. And maybe that looks like really deepening in monogamy because you've been all over the place and you've really avoided deep intimacy, and now it's time to stay and deepen. So it's really about upholding, and this is where the community of mirrors supports that each person stays true to their track, because they're really listening for each other and saying, like, you've been fooling around a lot. Why don't you go monogamous for a year and see how that heals you, how that supports you in your love path.
Ian, you just published an article. It's called Home is Whenever I'm With You and Other Modern Calamities. Mm-hmm. It's a nice, snappy title. And you tell a really beautiful story that, if you can briefly replicate mm-hmm. it here, mm-hmm. the point that I want to rest on in this moment is your movement from the myth of the one into what you called polyagony, mm-hmm. into this space of a village, mm-hmm. and the ascension through those different, I guess, in some ways, relational developmental stages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think in this culture, certainly you ask most people, what do they consider when you might say the myth of the one? And most people can come up with a fairly common set of terms, like the one that's meant to complete you, that's meant to be your other half, your soulmate.
My person.
Yeah.
Mine.
She's my person.
Mine.
And in many ways, again, it is a beautiful thing. And at the same time, every pop song ever sings about this. And yet there's a kind of less talked about consequence of that, which is all of the kind of unconscious projections that go into then trying to find that person or not. And then also all of the big energies that actually come through in any kind of relationship, especially around Eros, and the deep longing for belonging, which I think so many of us experience because haven't grown up with deep mutual life with other people. And so in a kind of fragmented, often lonely world, trying to find that other one makes total sense.
And in your article, you talk about that person as home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that idea that most people too would say they wouldn't challenge that assumption or that kind of characterization. They'd say, yeah, with this person, like, I feel home. And again, it's beautiful. It's not to knock it, but there's a kind of consequence when if you locate home in another person, what happens when that relationship ends, mm-hmm. as it often does? And for many, as it did for me, I was married for 6 years. And when that relationship ended, I literally lost my home. Like, I moved out, she stayed, it made a lot more sense for her to do so.
And you have to split up your friends, and maybe they're more social than you, so they get all the friends and you don't. You have to go on your long voyage to grieve and do a whole thing. Mm-hmm. I did that.
Drive off with your Vitamix.
That's true. I had three things left in my car. It was the kind of clothes and things, but it was the Nintendo Wii and the Vitamix. And for me, again, from that place, that reactivity, I was like, that's it. I'm not going to play into that anymore. I'm going to go the exact opposite, which in this case, and for many often, is the open relating, the non-monogamy, the polyamory. And it can feel like liberation, certainly after a time that felt more repressed and more boxed in. And yet what I found, like many do, and this is the polyagony, which is that all of the same issues that came up in the monogamous relationship just come up times however many, you know, people you're relating with. And so what I realized from that experience, and then finally going to Tamara, was I was like, oh, the missing piece has really little to do with the form of relationship that people are choosing to have, monogamy, polyamory, celibate, whatever. It's not about the form. It's about the vessel. Hmm. It's about needing others to actually hold, like, the big energies that come up in relating, and to mirror lovingly all of the blind spots, which are, by your very nature, you can't see about yourself, the ways you're relating, why you're choosing people based on unconscious mother projection or not, or all of these things that, again, are heroically impossible for an individual to see and to work with. And this is why, again, it really becomes a system change at that point, because the longing that many have but can't articulate, as well as the desire to be met in a kind of deep partnership of some kind, a lot of people carry, actually are no longer contradictory. Free love and partnership, as Tamara says, they're no longer contradictory if the vessel of community is there to hold them. In fact, they complement each other.
At the beginning of the podcast, we talked about a home run. And I just want to see how on track we are. Mm-hmm. And I want to pair that with what you said earlier, that the viewing of the film takes someone through the love school. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I remember what I had said in the beginning, which is that I think it would be a home run if by the end of this podcast, you and also those listening could really understand that the issues of love and sexuality that we're talking about have to do with the greater political revolution of our time.
It seems obvious to me that to heal our relationship to love would necessarily mean that we would need less consumption, less destruction of the earth, less conquering of each other, because our own coffers would be full by that love. I can conceptually understand this idea of healing of love as a political act, but I don't have access to how I could bring it into my own life. Mm-hmm. This is a question that I was going to save for later in the podcast, but we can't all go to Tamara.
No, we can't. When you break it down and look all the way to the core issue, it's like, wow, the society architecture is broken. And so to look at the fact that fundamentally, maybe from day one, we're not getting our needs met. And so as we grow into adulthood, we perpetuate the same problems and we're trying to fill that void with all this other stuff. And so here is a holistic model, and in a way can be like an island of the future, right? And also a beacon into what used to exist in the past when we did live in tribes. And so when I think about what's accessible for the here and now, I just think about, wow, we have to make those steps. We have to take those first steps to build trust with other people. So even if you live in an apartment, even if you live in your own house, what does it take to go next door to the neighbor? What does it take to invite the person that you have a feeling of resonance with into your living room and start to just create that culture of being transparent and really sharing, so that when you do need something, you can have those people that you call upon, people that listen for you and your partner. And you're like, all right, if we keep talking, we're just going to keep butting heads, but we bring in a third person, all of a sudden it's a circle. And then that can flow. It doesn't just ping pong back and forth. So these are the little steps that we can start to take. But we have to understand that the way as it is now, the society and the architecture of how we are set up to live is broken and keeps us isolated and keeps us in these patterns of destruction and violence.
The tricky thing in what you've just said is that I live in a city, and I can't point to the exact reason why, but I don't really want to talk to my neighbors. I just don't want to.
Nice transparency.
It feels uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So the idea that, like, let's create more organic communal bonds with the people who live with us, I think that many of the listeners at home would hear that and be like, oh, I don't want to do that. Sounds like a bunch of work. I'm already fighting with this person who I love and want to have sex with. What am I going to do with the dude next door who I'm pretty sure is a hoarder? What am I going to just, you know what I mean? And I'm not asking you to solve this particular right. challenge. I just, clearly we need like a radical system overhaul. And the nuclear family and these kind of atomized family units from the Industrial Revolution are awful. But much like the fight against climate change, the burden on the individual to make small choices in order to change the system, that feels overwhelming too. Mm-hmm. With that being the case, where do you draw hope? Is it about moving into the country and actually finding an intentional community? Like, mm-hmm. what is...
Yeah, I can speak to that. Okay, I'll give you this image. Tamara's whole vision is based on this idea that if they can essentially create these functional models of community, but a community in a particular way that has essentially removed like domination and coercion from every aspect of relationship between the human and human, human and the land, human and the animals. Like it creates a field of trust that is actually palpable when you go there. Like lots of people go there and they're like, oh my God, I don't know what it is. It just feels different.
Yeah. The trust thing I think is a key aspect here.
And so from that vision, they have this idea. In some ways, you could call it like, it's like reawakening a memory, right? And this is why we've talked about this idea of village. And certainly there's many places around the world that still live in village, different kinds of village. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, we also are talking about perhaps those peoples that have lost that memory, or it's just such a small ember. But I was reading the story around when I was reading The Vision. It was on the BBC or something. It was talking about this kid who he had some skin issue where his skin had mostly died over his entire body. All that was left was a few healthy patches of skin. And as I'm reading it, I'm kind of like, wow, that's devastating. But I kept reading, and the article was actually saying doctors had been successfully able to transplant some of the healed, or the one way to say it, the skin that still knew how to be itself, had transplanted it to other areas of the body. And that had kickstarted the memory again of the dead cells, and the skin regenerated across his entire being. And those two things collided with, for me, it's this image of reawakening the memory of this older way, but in a way calling it forward in places around the world, and it like strengthens the memory. They call it the field. And so how that looks, though, again, it doesn't necessarily mean everybody goes to the country, starts a 200 person intentional community. I, for example, though, live up in Canada and in a community home where there's 8 of us and are living and practicing these things every day. And I will say that it is phenomenal. All of that stuff you talked about, I don't know if I really want to be friends with that person, or and what do they think of me if they actually knew me and my habits and things like that. And it's fascinating how, and that's the threshold, though, that needs to be crossed in order to actually give, I think, any possibility of a regenerative future. I am utterly convinced that the future has to be collective. There's no other way.
How do you hope that the film that you have been making will forward the process you've just described of reestablishing healthy skin across this great, beautiful earth?
Mm-hmm. Well, one simple way is that we can't build what we haven't imagined. Mm-hmm. And so to create a visual representation through this film, which is a very powerful medium, we have the capacity to illuminate people's imagination, to even start to think about what that kind of change can look like.
Mm. This relates too to this understanding of the erotic, because with this understanding that Eros is life energy. Charles Eisenstein, I think we mentioned, he had this line from his book where he said that it's in the nature of life to want to make more life. And that's really the definition of Eros that we work with, that Eros wants to flow. And currently there are so few visions of what's possible that we would want to live into. There's lots of dystopian possibilities, zombie apocalypses and things like that. And in that sense, you could feel like the energy that wants to flow into these possibilities has nowhere to go, this energy. So this tension is actually just pooling. But with the possibility of actually offering up possible visions of a healed future, it allows that energy to be unlocked and actually begin to work towards creating that change.
Do you know of any other communities or experiments similar to Tamara that are successfully achieving some of these goals? Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd say there's hundreds, if not thousands, of different eco-villages around the world. Global Eco-Village Network is a great way to plug in. Some have different gifts, though, like Domenher, I think, in Italy. They talk with plants and they do all this really amazing futuristic stuff that, again, that feels like it's their strength. And I know there's communities in Kenya and Brazil that actually Tamara has relationships with.
And right here in the United States, there's The Farm in Tennessee, there's Twin Oaks, there's Our Eco Village, I think it's up in BC, right?
But none that emphasize this healing of gender relationships and healing of love as a foundational principle for the other work. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're fairly unparalleled in this regard.
And they really put it at center, though it's not the only thing. And so, again, in contrast to other intentional communities that might only take one aspect of what needs healing in our society, they've really taken on a holistic approach.
Mm-hmm. What is jealousy, and how do I get rid of it? Free love is great.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what comes up for me is one, Tamara says it really explicitly. And again, not everybody has to agree with them, but they hold that jealousy does not belong to love. That's one of their ethics. And what they mean is, of course, it comes up, but what they're trying to say is that it occupies a completely different area than love does. And then when you're able to actually go into it, create the space where you can have the container and the support to go into the nuances, of course, often for many, it's fear of loss, as well as the comparison to another. You know, how does one feel their own value in this situation, in a culture itself, which is, again, highly competitive, right? So there's so many elements there that within a different system, the question changes utterly. So for example, I'll give you a real example. When I was in the community a number of years ago, and there was a woman there who I was absolutely crushing hard the whole time within the Love School. And on the final evening, we had a celebration to end the school. By that point, we had a beautiful, friendly relationship. And I'd spoken to the attraction, and she was kind of like, okay, you know, I appreciate that. And anyway, at the end of it, the end of the night, and I was like, look, this is our final night together, and I would love to spend this with you if you're a yes to that. And she deliberated, and then kind of had to tell me that her choice in that moment was actually to go with this other man that was in the community. It's actually a really hot German fellow.
Did it feel better or worse that he was hot? I'm just curious, because like, he's hot and you're like, he's hot, but I'm not. But then if he's like not hot, you're like, but he's not hot.
Well, that's exactly right. All of a sudden the value systems come back in again. Yeah. But in that moment, of course, it was just a feeling of being chosen over. Yeah, of course, my self-worth was like, oh, I'm just a fool, or all those things came in. And then I had to, of course, honor the choice and respect. And it was appreciative that, of course, she said yes to that, which she wanted to say yes to, that man. And then it was actually really interesting that a year passed and I was in the community again for the Love School. And this year, the same woman wasn't there, but the fellow was. At that point, he was a resident of the community because they spent the night together and did what they did. And he came up to me actually kind of just on his own. He's like, hey, you were that guy, you know, from last year. And I was like, yeah, Ian. And he's like, this woman, she chose me over you. And he said that to me. And he wasn't saying it like, haha, she chose me over you. He's like, yeah, she chose me over you. I'm like, she did. And he's like, that must have been hard. And again, it was like, yeah, actually it was hard. But the sincerity I felt in him and the true kind of extension of a compassion that wasn't pity was actually a deep feeling of male solidarity that I hadn't felt actually ever. I didn't even know that was a thing. That he was like, yeah, that must have hurt. And I was like, yeah. And it wasn't, this shouldn't have happened. It wasn't, yeah, she should have gone with you. It wasn't, meh, too bad. It was actually just a deep moment of being, what was true was okay. And that we could meet in that place where it wasn't about him being better or worse or me being better. It was just what was true in that moment was held and honored. And solidarity was what made it happen, and trust. Mm-hmm.
This makes me think of one of the scenes that I watched from your movie, talking about solidarity in brotherhood, mm-hmm. in service of the feminine, mm-hmm. and that there's a male competitiveness. If she likes me, then I've won. And we're definitely socialized as men to play status games with each other. And I think women have a different version of this, speak broadly, and that there's this idea of coming together in service of women in a way that actually allows us to be in camaraderie and brotherhood with each other. Mm-hmm. That really resonates with me a lot. And I know that you've done a lot of work in masculinity, and that's mm-hmm. where you and I know each other from. It actually really is a nice tee up for something that I wanted to ask you, Ian, which mm-hmm. is, I met you at Rainbow Serpent in Australia, and you gave a talk that was called Love Beyond Fear. Is that the name of the talk?
Probably, or Love Free from Fear.
Love Free from Fear.
Yeah.
And I found that talk to have some really beautiful, very kind of actionable points to it. Mm-hmm. And thinking about someone listening at home, there's an invitation to create more community. There's an invitation to understand Tamara more. Certainly an invitation to watch your film. What about some of the lessons of Tamara that could be directly applicable to men and women in their interacting with the world we live in today? And I'm mm-hmm. thinking about your talk as mm-hmm. some of the lessons that you had to share.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I'm trying to leap back to that moment. And I can't specifically recall the key pieces. But I do feel like in this moment, what comes is, one, to recognize that everything that comes up from relationships, whether or not it's a pair or a trio or beyond, that what comes up there is big, that it's too difficult to hold alone. And that in some sense, we blame ourselves for the challenges so much of the time, or we blame the other, not realizing that, again, it lies in the structure, in the ways that we're relating. And so to invite the larger container is crucial. But the other piece is, in terms of real practice, is for me, it's this understanding of the term contact. The more I begin to think about and practice and try to understand this idea of contact, is that whenever one relates with another, whether it's you and yourself, you and another human, you and non-human world, it's such a moment of profound possibility. And it asks actually a lot that for one to be able to, let's say just the example you used, so it's a man approaching a woman, that to one be really aware of what's going on in him in that moment, to be able to say like, wow, yeah, what am I, you know, am I just really in lust in this moment? Am I actually just feeling really alone? So I need to find status by going to talk to this woman. Am I genuinely curious who she is? Am I just angry at my partner back home? So I'm going to do it to spite her. There's so many things that could be going on. So to like be able to pause and take that moment and be like, yeah, what's actually going on for me right now? And then when the approach is made to in the contact, to be genuinely willing to be curious about what is going on for them and where does it lead based on, is there an invitation? Is there a no? Is it whatever's happening, to also be able to honor that and to make true contact with them allows then for the presence of truth.
I remember in your talk, you observed your own story. And I know I want to just flag for a moment that we're being pretty heteronormative in this moment, and that's my fault. I'm the one who kind of teed it up. You're a man. You're talking to a woman. Mm-hmm. Let me just flag that. In the context of a heterosexual man approaching someone he presumes may be a potentially interested mm-hmm. woman, that there's this idea of understanding the desire for contact. And then actually having an open space for who they are and what they want. And what you talked about in your talk was observing that you are telling a story about this person. Uh-huh. You've never met them. You don't know anything about them. You've had kind of an idea of what they look like, but you could be running an entire story about who they are, what they want, what they mean to you. Oh, women always do this. But if I try this, and that there's something about trying to drop that story completely. First, you understand why you're approaching, drop the story completely, and then you're actually able to hold like, mm-hmm. who are you? What's happening here? And and I think that's a helpful process for anyone who wants to create an erotic invitation or any kind of intimate invitation for another person.
Yeah. I can even relate it to a non-sexual encounter in that when I think about my baby and I think about making contact with my baby and I watch her, she's sometimes in her own world. She's engaging with something, maybe she's holding something or looking in a certain direction. And I see this all the time because I go to the grocery store and at least 10 people kind of like enter her sphere and like, ooh, what a cute baby, you know? And it's like, okay, great. Obviously I love that. And at the same time, I feel like, wow, we adults are so used to just intruding upon the space of young people, especially babies, because they're like, they can't fend for themselves. But to actually come and make contact would be to be aware, like, okay, in this moment, she's actually like really engaging with this rock and she's figuring out the world in her very own way. Mm. And so just to be aware, am I interrupting with my own agenda for contact with her? Or is she actually reaching for me and looking and ready to be embraced? And so it can just be as simple as that.
Yeah, and I'd like to add, actually, for me, I mean, this whole question around consent is quite lively, I think, in this culture and necessary. And what I feel like I've understood actually by being in Tamara is how there's a deeper layer than consent, actually. There's a deeper layer that needs to be met for consent to be properly given. And for me, that's what contact is. It's the capacity actually to move at a pace and with a curiosity and an awareness of like what's actually true in this moment. And then from there, and again, particularly say an erotic encounter, if the goal is already existent before contact is made, then you're out of contact. Does that make sense? If you approach an encounter and you're like, this has to lead to sex, which that's generally like a criticism of people that use Tinder or whatever. Like there's ways in which people come front loaded with this idea that, okay, this has to get to sex or it has to be orgasm, for example. But it's a very different goal if you're coming from a place of contact and the goal is contact. So whatever happens, you're actually succeeding if the goal is contact, because whatever comes up is actually what's true in that moment.
Well, and that really liberates this fear of rejection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are certain kinds of consent violations, certainly not the most egregious consent violations, but certainly kinds of consent violations that involve a fear of rejection, actually on both sides. For people who are in the position of asserting themselves generally, but I think particularly, especially men, this idea of rejection is so much a referendum on identity. Yeah. And so therefore, if I'm not hearing a no, I'm not hearing a no. And then on the other side, the person who's being approached, there's so many reasons why she or they might not want to say no. They might want sex, but later. They might want a friendship. They might not want to hurt his feelings. What's really good in this that I think is really helpful is your own relationship to yourself and what you're putting on the line when you approach someone. So if you can check in with yourself and say, actually, I don't feel very good about myself, and I'm on Tinder because I want a match. And if I get a match, then it's going to tell me I'm good and good looking and hot and blah, 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 and gimme the gimme. Yep. At least you know that. At least you've checked in and you know that. That's a great first step to being like, is this really feeding me?
This invites too, again, what the power is of inviting others to be, and this is a Tamara term, embedment, E-M-B-E-D-D-M-E-N-T. This idea of being able to like take the step of actually making public, but in a right way, these kinds of, you know, longings, impulses, ideas. So for example, being able to check, hey, I want to go talk to that person, but you ask the friend first and you say, hey, I feel like really attracted to that person. Can I go talk to them or should I go talk to them? And they might say, okay, so what's going on for you right now? Giving you the moment to pause and actually help you to be like, oh yeah, I'm just totally projecting on them right now. And actually it's not a good idea for me to talk to them. How much we get caught in our own programming and projections that actually really hard to do that. And so by embedding, and even like encounters, for example, in Tamara, it's very standard practice when there's a connection made and maybe there is a kind of erotic element to it that they want to explore. Let's say you're in a social environment. It's very common where when the two people, let's say, go to leave, they would embed that they're about to leave. Like oftentimes, you know, one of the most profound experiences I had was with the Tamarans, not in Tamara, it was at another conference, when I met this person and, you know, we were kind of flirting and connecting and we were in the social field with the whole group. And at one point we're like, okay, we want to take this to a more private area. So we go to leave. Bye, everybody. Go to leave. And one of the main Tamarans, who's actually the co-founder of the Love School, he's like, where are you guys going? And I'm like, elsewhere? And he's like, ah, but it seems like a beautiful connection's been made. Would you tell us about it? Right? And we're like, what? And there's like 30 people at this table. And I'm like, what is happening? But he wasn't doing it to put me on the spot, quote, but it was this automatic, I think, instinct of, yeah, like, why keep it to yourself? This is also the gift of community in that way, is that so much of like privatizing, one can maybe feel like it's like hoarding, right? This life energy, which is actually really beautiful to, in a trust field, to be able to speak about it. And often, you know, in that moment to say, what are you actually attracted to in this person in that moment? And by sharing it with the group, it's like you get to hear yourself. So of course you can all of a sudden be aware, am I playing games now? Am I just making stuff up? Or what's actually authentic right now? And can I speak it to them, witnessed by the group? And they can give mirrors too and say, oh, lovely. Or say, I think you were trying to put on a show or something like. But it just creates a whole other dynamic and a safer one, by the way, because the two disappear and everybody's seen that it's been embedded and they know, oh yeah, they've off. It's like the field knows now, oh, I should check on with so-and-so later. Or like, how was that? And bring them back into the fold later.
We see the consequence of not doing that is Me Too. It's essentially so much happening in private and in the shadows. And in this way, by embedding what's happening, you don't live with all those 30 people around the table, but that was a practice of being in community in that moment. So there are ways that we can act as communitarian beings in any moment by considering that we at any given moment have impact on the whole.
Earlier, you talked about a field of trust. Just now, we're talking about safety. And Julia, I'm interested in how it felt for you as a woman to be at Tamara, how the differences that you felt in being in that space versus in some of the other kind of public spaces in the world, and what effect that had on you, and potentially how that has changed the way you interact outside of Tamara.
Oh, wow. Yeah. There's so much to say about that. Well, a few little vignettes come to mind. I remember one time, it was my first year there, it was 2016, and it was hot. Like, it was a hot day and I was wearing this long skirt with a belly shirt, like my midriff was showing. And it was a break during the Global Love School, and I'd gone to the bathroom, and in transit I had run into Sabina Lichtenfels, who's one of the co-founders of the whole project and also of the Global Love School. And she stopped me to be like, oh, do you know that this way you attract? And I was like, What? What is she talking about?
Do you know that this way you attract? You know? I'm going to use that.
And in that way, it was like, oh my God, in this moment, all my stuff could potentially have come up of being shamed, older woman, mom telling me it's not okay, whatever. But actually what she was doing was bringing it into my awareness that I was an attractive woman in that moment. Mm-hmm. That the way that I was dressing could potentially be received as beautiful or seductive or enticing, and just to bring it into my awareness. So not in the vein of, oh yeah, you're going to be asking for it, you know, but like, just be aware. And so it's interesting to come as a woman into a field of permission. I think the strongest feeling I've had of being in that field again and again is that there's a lot of permission to be an erotic being. There's no pressure, there's no expectation to make sexual contact at all. But there is a field of permission, just as in that way that I was acknowledged by the elder. There's just space to explore and to express longings, desires. And because I had a little bit of time already at One Taste, I was familiar and felt comfortable in a field of community talking about sexuality and desire. So I had a bit of a pre-existing, I'd been primed for that experience already. And yet there were still ways that I could come up against my own edge, because the society I grew up in did not create that field of permission for me as a sexual being. And certainly not in my family as I was growing up. So I often experienced, especially in my adolescence, just this feeling of needing to hide that I was a sexual being. And one of the really profound experiences for me happened, actually, Ian and I did an interview with a young woman who grew up in the project named Naila. And she spoke about her story of having an initiation into her sexuality that was held by the community. So she literally named, I am ready to enter into the community and be seen as a sexual being, and maybe I want to have sex with a person I'm attracted to, invited that person to a sexual encounter, and then invited her mom, her dad, and the community to come and have a party while they go into a room and have sex. So just imagine that. If I had that, it was such a stark contrast to my experience of needing to hide coming into my own sexual self. And I realized that it's possible, right? So long as there is a field of adults that can create safety and permission, then it can be a good experience, especially for a young woman that's coming into herself and needs orientation on how to come into herself in that way. So there was a healing moment for me just in receiving her story. I would say that something I've known about myself is that I know that I'm a sexual being. I know I love sexuality. I love that it's expressed. I love it when people express that they are sexual beings. And in Tamara, I found that in that field, I was met with a lot of acceptance for my desire, and I actually had a lot of beautiful encounters with various people and experienced that there wasn't conflict between the people who knew about each other. There's actually a moment where I remember Ian and I were lovers at the time, and there was a man in the Global Love School who decided to express his attraction to me. And so he used that principle of embedment. And there was actually, I think it was Ian and a woman that he was attracted to, plus another man, and then this man expressing his attraction to me, but in front of all of them, and essentially saying he wanted to sleep with me. And Ian standing there like, great. And there's just...
without jealousy.
And it was revolutionary. Just in the fact that these two men could stand side by side, that man could vulnerably express, wow, I really have feelings for you and I'd like to pursue them, and do you feel the same? And for my current lover to stand and hear that and hear my response authentically, that was a big deal, something I had not had before.
Yeah, I can add that so much of that was largely based on that there was trust. within the field and among the men or with the men. There was a level of a feeling of, he's a human being. He's a man like me. And that, again, that competition wasn't there. And also because the way that it's held there, like these kinds of dynamics are normalized, right? In a way that it's like, it makes it more apparent when the kind of conditioned reactions that are in this culture, like there's a different normalization here where violence or upsetness because, you know, that so-and-so is with so-and-so and that's more like, oh yeah, of course, that's the way it is. But there it's the exact opposite. You're really able to see how the conditioned responses show up. And it's funny to see too about how the mirror image, when there's trust, it's really fascinating. For example, in this culture, probably the most egregious thing that partners can do, let's say, is to have one of them say, sleep with the best friend, for example, right? That's upheld. That's the worst that you can possibly do. In Tamara, it's the exact opposite.
It's the best.
Yeah, exactly. In Tamara, you're like, oh, I love this person who's a really good friend. And I love my partner, lover, like who I want to see them both flourish.
They should love each other too.
This is called compersion, right? Is that the
Certainly,
a
that's
funny
the,
name for a great idea?
Yeah, that's the polydynamic here. That's the word often. But again, it's interesting to me too that now I draw a parallel to Christopher Ryan's book, Sex at Dawn, which many have read. In reference. And if I recall, he makes a comparison that humans are actually a lot less like chimpanzees and a lot closer in kinship to bonobos. And bonobos use their connecting as a bonding practice amongst the group of them. And so in Tamara, like when there's the trust field, you start to see this actually unfold. And I think Julia just gave a beautiful example. When it's held in a trust field where, again, there's the competition evaporates because you realize like everybody's still in the village, it's not a big fear of loss or they're going to leave me and I'm going to be alone. It's, oh, okay, this is what's happening now. And things come up, but they're held in a different way. And it creates actually more trust.
To bring it on home, I want to come back to the first question here and the first idea, which is the healing of our relationship to the erotic, the healing of the genders as a political revolution and mm-hmm. perhaps the foundational political revolution. And I am very accustomed to having conversations with hippies about how they're going to dance and free Tibet. Yeah. Like where, there was a whole festival that's like, we're all going to get together and dance and then Tibet will become free. Mm-hmm. And I'm all for the power of manifestation and intentions, but there seems to be a kind of woo-woo disconnect between we're going to do this thing that feels good, our healing, our thing, and it's changing the world. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could express to me, what is the direct through line, if you can describe it succinctly, between this healing of gender relationships and the political revolution that this world needs?
Mm-hmm. Well, one way to look at it is that when any one of us looks at our personal life, the issues that we're grappling with, the questions that we have, and then we zoom out, any number of those could be a microcosm of the macrocosm that we're living in. So if two people in a relationship who are enacting violent patterns take a decision to step out of that and start to commit themselves to a culture of peace between them, that's already one step in a political direction. If a country that is oppressing one gender rather than the other, and there are many who, for example, still oppress women far more than men, starts to look at, okay, on the political front lines, if it's a matter of going to war, we want everybody in the army. But when we're back home, like the woman has to cover her head and she can't flirt with anyone outside of her marriage and this kind of thing. If we start to deconstruct those political systems and understand that's a personal issue that's now politicized, because that's an issue of a personal relationship, and we need to look at how does that actually impact the society and the culture and the well-being of a people. Who is it that's in the role of decision making? What are the layers of oppression that we're living under, whether it's being conditioned, whether our erotic bodies have been occupied by pornography, or whether our food systems have been occupied by Monsanto. It's not different. It's not different. The personal is the political. And I think when we start to look at that, we can take all the small steps that we need to start to dismantle those systems on a larger scale.
I could add that I spent time in a previous film I worked on, it's called Occupy Love. And we did look at the first year of the Occupy movement and trying to track how that was part of the larger cultural wave that swept the globe in 2011. And like, what were the parts that seemed to actually align, even though the groups, quote, didn't necessarily know each other directly at the outset, even though they wove together by the end. And for me, what that proved was, I don't believe there is a top-down, quote, solution to what we, the type of change we need and the amount of time that we need to change it. I don't think it's possible. The system itself is incapable of responding at the scale that is necessary in which to create change. And so for me, it's like, well, what's the other, you know, without resorting to like magical woo-woo thinking, so what is the other theory of change? And for me, the theory of change is actually goes right back to this question of eros and emergence. Because if you look out at life, like nobody's in charge of life. Nobody's in charge of, okay, tree, grow there, bee, go over there. Like there's an intelligence that is just unfolding that is embedded within life. Life wants to create more life. And so I think the great calamity that's occurred in, with our human systems is that we've basically fell out of contact with life. Because all indigenous cultures, to say, are based on their very nature of being indigenous, are in contact with life. Like it's a call and response, this relationship to place and to the beings of place. And the great forgetting that's happened and the great kind of decoupling from the land and colonization and all that is a great forgetting. And so in some sense, we don't have to apply a magnificent amount of force against, quote, the bad people or the Trumps to get the change to happen. But I do think we have to align with the innate intelligence of life, which the only way we can do that is if we ourselves free the occupation of ourselves and tap back into our ability to tune in to that intelligence. And then we will be guided where we need to be. Where we are most alive is where we need to be. That's the core of the evolution. And to liberate ourselves, we need the collective. I fully believe it cannot be done. Like the hero alone, as able to transcend on their own, I think is done. And Thich Nhat Hanh said the next Buddha will be Sangha. And this is, Tamara's a model of what's possible when people commit to doing this work and then partnering with life.
Well, as so often with experiences such as this, I will have to digest it somewhat before I'm able to tell you whether transformation has occurred. And like all transformations, it's the integration and practice of mm-hmm. it anyway. Mm-hmm. So I will say that I have been opened up to a lot of ideas, and I really want to go to Tamara now. Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you so much for talking to me today. Did my paradigm shift? Did it though?
You have to wait for it. It never happens in the moment. Emergent, only in retrospect.
I'm an emergent property of a desire to have paradigm shift.
You might have to sleep on it.
I think I'm going to sleep on it. Sleep with it. Hey.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.